Good evening to everybody in Burgage Hall. Good evening to everybody online. Welcome to Ledbury. My name is Peter Florence. I'm a patron of the Ledbury Poetry Festival. It is my very great honour to introduce the speaker for this evening, who is going to talk about this fabulous book, Shakespeare's First Folio. It's a book about Shakespeare, of course, but it's a book about Jagad and Blount, about Heming and Condell. It's a book about compositing and casting off. It's a book about the publication of the most remarkable work of literature ever published. As the great Tom Mashler, publisher of Jonathan Cape, always said, publishing is an awful lot easier if what you're publishing is full of wonders. And there was nothing, and never has been anything, quite like the tragedies, comedies, and histories of William Shakespeare. Emma is going to talk for about 40 minutes, and then I'm going to pop back onto stage and ask questions and take questions from you on the floor and you online. I should say about her that she teaches at Hartford. She is the Oxford Professor of Shakespeare. She's written a fantastic book, This is Shakespeare, and since 2016 has been one of the great voices talking about Shakespeare, not only in the academic world, but out everywhere. And it's a thrill to have her here, and it will be a thrill to hear her. Please join me in giving her a very warm welcome.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Peter. It's a real pleasure to be here at Ledbury. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for joining us this evening. As Peter said, I'm going to be talking about this book and its 400th birthday. But I'm going to start with where it come from, where it came from, why we got it, what happened along the way, and we'll get to some of the later stories about it. It's a wonderful object. There are a number on display in this 400th anniversary year, so if you're inspired and can get yourself to Shakespeare's Globe on London's Bankside, to John Ryland's maybe library in Manchester, or to Edinburgh, depending on how your rest of the year schedule looks, those will be opportunities to see it in the flesh. So let's start with where this book comes from. Why do we get this collection of plays, Master William Shakespeare's comedies, histories and tragedies, the book that later became known as the First Folio? How do we get this published in 1623? Let's start here. I'm not going to give you a test either of your eyesight or of your paleography skills, but this is a little snippet from Shakespeare's will. It's not in his own handwriting, but you can just see, even if you can just see the lines, you can see some of the second thoughts that Shakespeare has had while he is dictating this will in March 1616, just a few weeks before his death. We're not looking at the most famous of those second thoughts, which you might remember was the gift of the second best bed to his wife. Perhaps that's a controversy we'll avoid, but maybe we'll talk about it in the questions. But here, actually, we've got another second thought interleaved into the text of the will, and it's a bequest to my fellows John Heming, Richard Burbage, and Henry Condell, 28 shillings for rings. The giving of mourning rings, memorial rings, was a very common practice in funerary culture. And what Shakespeare is doing here is giving to his fellow actors, three men with whom he had been working for more than 20 years, these tokens of remembrance. For many scholars, the assumption has been that implicitly or explicitly, Shakespeare was also saying, and do me a proper memorial, get my plays gathered together, get my book out. We don't know about that, but we do know that Heming and Condell, Burbage opted out, although he had died, so I suppose that's forgivable. In brackets, it's my favourite epitaph of a great era of epitaphs, is the epitaph for the actor Richard Burbage, which is Exit Burbage. Isn't it good? Really, really good. So here we've got Heming and Condell, who sign the epistle to the readers at the beginning of this book. So one argument about the Genesis is that actually, although 1623, you will have worked out, is 7 years after Shakespeare's death in 1616, that nevertheless, perhaps he himself had set in motion plans for its publication. Now, that can't be absolutely securely stated, and it in fact plays into a bigger argument in Shakespeare scholarship about the extent to which Shakespeare was interested in print publication. And that's an argument which has lots of interesting aspects and no completely settled conclusion. So Shakespeare himself as the origin of this book. It's also a book that comes from publishing. Peter's introduction made that really clear. However many wonders there are in the work, unless it gets published, we don't get to see them. And so publishers are who sometimes get a difficult kind of rap in the modern industry are really, you know, absolutely crucial to all kinds of literary production. We can see that Isaac Jaggard and Edward Blunt are named on the title page. Edward Blunt is more the kind of publisher figure. That's to say, he probably puts up the money. He picks the title and puts up the money. And the Jaggards, Isaac and his father William, have a print shop. So they own a printing press and type and employ compositors. So they are the sort of mechanicals. They are the artisans in the process. I like the fact that William Jaggard, who has had a long printing career and is very ill by the time this book comes into his firm, is seeding organisation, really, to his son, Isaac. And this is a very ambitious book for the Jaggards, and it's nice to think of Isaac, you know, as a young man, given the increasing control of the family firm, thinking, I'm going to do something more ambitious. I'm going to do more than the general playbill printing, this kind of ordinary work that we've been doing in the firm under my father. They had printed a group of plays that seems to have been an abortive attempt to produce a sort of serial edition of Shakespeare, sometimes called the Pavier Quartos. We used to think that these were pirated editions and that they were produced without the agreement of the theatre company. In this period, play scripts belong to the theatre company, not to the author. They're bought by the company or they're paid for by the company. But we now think that these Pavier Quartos may have been a sort of dry run, in a way, for testing the market for a Shakespeare edition. So printing, then, publishing is another driver for this book. And finally, there's a bit of competition. I love this, the modern portmanteau word, frenemy, which you've probably come across, and it always strikes me as really beautifully pitched for the relationship between Shakespeare and Johnson, who were great frenemies through the 1610s and earlier. It's possible that Johnson and Shakespeare wrote together, but it may be that they just maintained this kind of rivalry. Johnson produces an edition of his own works in 1616, and Shakespeare must have known that that work, that volume was in preparation around the time of his illness and death. And that may too have given a spur to the idea that if Johnson can do it, Shakespeare can do it. But what's unique about these two books is that they are the first vernacular, that's to say English language, books of plays to be printed in this folio format. So folio is a size. It's not an absolute size. In fact, it's a relative size, but it means that each sheet of paper is folded just once to create four printed pages, two leaves. And it produces a book that is substantial in size. If you do get to see one, you'll see that it's about full scap in dimensions, about 2 or 3 inches thick, a heavy weight book with 900 pages. One of the things that's important about this book and important about its survival,
obviously other wonders Peter already alluded to inside it, but it's also a difficult book to lose. It's a big wodge of book, and it's like if you look at the books that are perhaps most preserved in your house or in your family, they are probably the big, rather glossy, expensive ones you never really dare touch, and you put away or put up on the shelf and don't get down, whereas, you know, Dogger or whatever the, you know, books that the kids are reading to pieces or paperbacks that you really enjoy are, you know, probably quite fragile or quite vulnerable to destruction. And there is something about that in one part of the survival of Shakespeare's first folio. It's just size. So let's look at it again. Here's the front page. One of the things that's really important about this book is this author portrait. Not a particularly good portrait, it has to be said. There's a sort of, I always think of those animations in Monty Python, the Monty Python sort of credits, and I think of the head bouncing away. It's definitely not properly attached to the body, is it? And that's almost certainly because the body is a sort of all-purpose, you know, body fits all heads, and the head is probably modelled on a painting, but we don't have that painting. What the presenters of this book are saying, unusually, let's look back to Johnson. What Johnson is saying is, I'm a classical writer, here are the figures of comedy and tragedy, here is this sort of architectural frontispiece. What the those who prepare Shakespeare's first folio seem to be saying is, here's a man, here's a person, here's somebody who's looking out at you, here's a body of work, which is the body of a person. And we can see that one of the things the folio compilers have done is to minimise Shakespeare's collaborations with other writers and to maximise the sense of him as a single author. And that's something which we have inherited. So let's just go back. So here we've got the catalogue of what's included. If you were able to be with us when Don Patterson and Peter and I were talking about the sonnets earlier, you'll remember that the sonnets are not part of this collection, and nor indeed are any of Shakespeare's non-dramatic poems. This is a collection that comes from the theatre, and it thinks of Shakespeare as a playwright. It divides the plays, as you can see, into comedies, histories, and tragedies. It's put the histories very clearly into the order of the kings. Trevor Nunn, the theatre director, calls this Shakespeare's box set, which I really like. So someone's done some work to organise that section, to retitle some of the plays and to make it clear that this is a kind of serial sequence of English kings, but we don't know what the order of the other plays is. It may be that they've put some of the ones that haven't been published first. For a long time, people thought The Tempest was first because it was Shakespeare's first play. We don't now think that, but we've been struggling a bit to see what's the order there. I'm just going to do this act of vandalism now, which is to show you, by crossing them out, the plays that we wouldn't have if this book had not been published. We'll look in a minute at the previous publications of Shakespeare before this big collection. But what's important to remember at this point is that 18 of the plays had not previously been printed. And had they not been gathered together in this book, we almost certainly would not have them now. So a majority of plays from this period have been lost. They were never printed. They had done their job by being plays in the theatre. Play books are still not a completely standard form of publication by the Jacobean period. So most plays have been lost, and it's print that's preserved them, and pretty much only print. So without the first folio, we wouldn't have, as we always say, Macbeth or Twelfth Night, The Tempest, Antony and Cleopatra, Julius Caesar, As You Like It, and so on. We'd also have a Shakespeare who is really quite predominantly a history writer. If you can see where the crossings out are least prominent, it's in the genre of history. And that might have made a Shakespeare who seemed more English in his concerns, maybe a little bit more parochial. Perhaps this is not Shakespeare who would have gone global and seemed applicable to everybody. Slightly fewer tragedies than we are used to, and then that block of early comedy. So this is a Shakespeare who would have looked very, very different. Let's just look for a moment at some of the previous publications. These are all what are often called quartos. So I said that folio is a piece of paper folded once. Quarto is folded again, so it's half the size. But these are essentially pamphlets, single plays, quite disposable, quite cheap, exist in relatively small numbers, often were read to death or were lost because they weren't bound in larger volumes. I love looking at these. I love looking at how typography changes and how it seems right to put the most lamentable Roman tragedy of Titus Andronicus at the top, or on the bottom line, the most excellent and lamentable tragedy of Romeo and Juliet down there. And there's lots we can learn from these amazing documents. Something about the rise of Shakespeare. The first plays are not printed with his name. That becomes more prominent later on. And it becomes prominent probably to the extent that people pass off plays that are not by Shakespeare under Shakespeare's name. And it looks, disappointingly for me as a person from Leeds, proudly from Leeds, it looks as if a Yorkshire tragedy, not so new as lamentable and true, probably is not by Shakespeare, despite the claim. So these quarto publications are what we would have had instead of the folio, and partly what makes them a more fragile form of survival, just is their material form. Okay, so let's have a look again at the sheet that we saw, just the signatures. We saw Heming and Condell. And I wanted to show you this because I was trying to think about how this book is pitched. Who's it for? It's an expensive book. It costs about £1. Now, what does that mean? It's not particularly meaningful, is it? Those individual play quartos that we just looked at would have cost sixpence. It would have cost a penny, possibly a bit more, to go to the theatre. So this is a relatively large sum of money. It's quite a narrow sphere of people who are going to be able to afford to buy it or who are going to want to buy it. And I think, although in retrospect it looks to us as if everybody must have wanted to buy this wonderful book, I don't think that is how it seemed at the time. I think there was a sense of financial or commercial jeopardy about this. And we can see that perhaps a bit here in these bits from Heming and Condell that I've picked out. This epistle begins, "To the great variety of readers." And that sounds like a thing that we're so used to, you know, that Shakespeare is for everybody, this is addressed to everybody. But then they move quite quickly. "The fate of all books depends on your capacities, and not of your heads alone, but of your purses." So quite quickly we're into the money. That's what this preface is about. And that goes through the epistle. "Read and censure. Do so, but buy it first." So we don't really mind if you don't like it, so long as you've bought it. That's what we need. Whatever you do, buy. There's a bit of desperation there. And then I always think of this. I come from a very proud family of English teachers. I think of this as the motto of English teachers. "Read him, therefore, and again and again. And then, if you do not like him, surely you are in some manifest danger not to understand him." The only reason not to like Shakespeare is your own failure to understand. And here, Hemings and Condell give us that straight away. I thought we'd just spend a little bit of time thinking about the printing press and the printing process. I already said that this is a big undertaking for Jaggard's print shop. 36 plays, 900 pages, a big job of work, a big investment, particularly the investment in paper. There is no English print quality paper during this period, so it's all imported with, you know, supply chain issues and also expense. But I love it when we find the tiny details of some of the people who put this book together. And the bottom picture shows you a fingerprint from the print shop. This is someone who has the job, I think, of picking off the damp sheets of paper. Paper needed to be dampened to take the ink. Taking it off the press and putting it somewhere in the print shop to dry. And they have... It's amazing to me that there's not more mess around. I'm so clumsy and messy myself, I would be completely covered with the very sticky printer's ink that they produce. But we do see these fingerprints sometimes, and here's a nice one. It's a nice reminder that these are not works that just sort of magically or inspirationally come from the head of the brain of the writer or the quill pen of Shakespeare. They come to us through the intermediary of all kinds of labour, including in the print shop. And we've got a nice picture of the print shop up there. You can see the two men who are working at the press. One of them is inking with those leather balls, the set type, and the other is fixing the paper so that they can fold it over and roll it under the press. And in the back of that picture, in the good light, we can see the men who are working as compositors. So they have to pick out each individual piece of type. The pieces of type are called sorts. They have capital letters in the uppercase and small letters in the lowercase, in the cases that they have there, words that we've kept, even if we've lost the technology which required them. And they have to set every single letter of Shakespeare's plays, millions and millions and millions of sorts. It's an extraordinary job. It's a job of deciphering, sometimes working from manuscript, sometimes working from print. It's a job of working out how much space is going to be needed and, you know, keeping all kinds of things in their mind. We often think about them as people who make mistakes, and we're going to talk about mistakes in a minute. But what is wonderful to me is how few mistakes they make. If you've ever tried to do any kind of printing, if you ever had a John Bull printing set, you may just remember after about, you know, 3/4 of an hour, it was so exhausting to do anything and to find you'd got it all wrong and take it all out again. It's an amazing piece of work. I wanted to show you this again. I'm not going to ask you to look at the specific words, but I hope you can just see the outline of this on the page. I wanted to show you this because one of the ways the print shop works is by dividing up the copy in order that different people can work on it and in order that the book can be put together in these sort of nested leaves, folded leaves. You can imagine that if you're trying to make a brochure or something, you know that page one and page two are not on the same piece of paper, are they? Page one and page eight or something are on the same piece of paper. And that's what is working here. A senior member of the print house team needs to do a process called casting off, which is to work out how much space a certain amount of handwritten copy or printed copy is going to take in order to say, this is your bit. And you've got to meet up with this. It's a bit like digging a tunnel from both ends and making sure you meet in the middle. We can see that printers know how to flex the amount of space that they're using. And on the left-hand side, you can see printers who are using up a lot of space in order to set their type. They've got a lot of white space around the songs, a lot of spare lines around stage directions. This is a very leisurely kind of piece of typesetting. On the right, I hope you can see that you've actually got a much more condensed squeezing in. This has got to be finished by the end of the page, and you can see an increasing anxiety that it's not all going to fit in. I feel as if we've all had this, haven't we, doing a poster or doing a something and thinking, oh God, I haven't left enough space to get all this done. If we just make it a bit bigger, you can see for example, five or six lines up from the bottom, the stage direction enter mess for enter messenger is all squeezed in. There's a stage direction which we know has been dropped in order to make a bit more space. So that's a way that the way these plays look on the page is very much a clue to how workers are deciding and operating. Here's another example of something about how the print house is working. This is about correction. To what extent was this book proofread or copy edited, as we might say in modern terms? And the answer is not really very much at all. And it's much more heavily proofread in the certain areas that have been worked on by a new worker in Jagad's print shop, an apprentice who we know was called John Leeson. Leeson is apprenticed in October 1622, so he has his first year of working in a print shop, working on this extraordinarily complex book. And one of the things that's really useful about Leeson's presence is it shows you how skillful the journeyman printers who've gone through that period of training are, and how many, what a higher error rate there is if you're new on the job. And Leeson was new on the job, and he has his work quite heavily supervised and checked. What nobody seems to have done is to check the text against the copy. So someone is here looking at things that are effectively typos, misspacings, turned letters, that kind of thing. So something that you could just look at the page and say, that's wrong. You don't need to check and say, actually, that was meant to be Theseus rather than Tarsius or something. There's none of that. And we can see in a few examples, and we've got one here, this rather ghostly copy. It's a black and white image rather than a strange book. We can see down that margin, you can see some little marks that if you know proofreading, you can see they're still the same marks that proofreaders use. This is somebody who's marking up errors that need to be changed. And what seems to have happened is the press keeps running. They keep producing pages from the set type. Somebody looks at one of the early pages and makes the corrections. They stop the press, they open it up, they open up the case with the type in it, they make the corrections, secure it all again, and carry on with the rest of the run. So all copies of the first folio have a mixture of corrected and uncorrected sheets. You'll also know, I mean, these are very, very human processes, that if you correct a mistake, you often make another one in doing that, and sometimes you don't correct the mistake at all. And we can see that here. We can see that the one that I've put a circle around has just been missed. That hasn't been corrected. And, oh fool, I shall go mad, where I've put the line in King Lear. By correcting that, we get a mistake in that the type block has been raised and it makes an impression. So these are all just tiny little ways of seeing. We get this book through all kinds of individual acts of work, as well as through the governing invention that is Shakespeare writing the plays. Because of that sense that the book had not been properly proofread or copy edited, that it was full of mistakes, what we can see from early readers is that they're very, very happy to make corrections. Sometimes of things that clearly are wrong, sometimes of things which are a bit more marginal, whether they're mistakes or not. And it's a nice example of a time when Shakespeare was not so revered that we felt that every single word or comma must have been intentional and therefore, you know, needs our ingenuity to explain it. So these are readers from different copies who are making different kinds of correction. Sometimes they're correcting the Latin just to show that they can, presumably. At the bottom there, you may just be able to see that block out. That's somebody blocking out one of the oaths that Lancelot Gobbo, the cheeky servant of the Merchant of Venice, utters. That was obviously a person who didn't want that. Somebody's added an exit sign here. I like that one there, which is from Romeo and Juliet, and it's a scene with Juliet and the friar and Romeo. And Juliet and the friar are talking together, and then the friar, according to the folio, says, Ah, Juliet, if the measure of thy joy be heaped like mine, and that thy skill be more to blazon it, then sweeten with thy breath this neighbour air, and let rich music's tongue unfold the imagined happiness that both receive in either by this dear encounter. And this reader has thought, that's weird. The friar shouldn't say such a thing. It's not appropriate. And they've put, this is must be Romeo. They've made the decision, this must be Romeo speaking. So it's an example of the way the book enables readers, or was seen to enable early readers, to engage with it and to develop it in ways which were interesting to them. Here's another couple of examples. On the left-hand side, we've got a copy which is now in the University of Glasgow, which I think belonged to the family of Lucius Carey around Great Tew in Oxfordshire. The Careys came back from service in Ireland in the mid-1620s, and I think the young men of the family really threw themselves into London culture. They'd been out in the sticks, and I think they really enjoyed themselves. And one of the things they have done as a family is to mark up which of these actors they've seen. So it's a sort of, it's almost like a kind of sticker album or something. You know, it's a piece of fan literature. So they've said who they have seen. Here, this is young Elizabeth about 1712. She's obviously had a lovely time using this bit of spare paper to do her drawing on, and in the process showed us that children's drawings haven't really changed all that much over 200 years. I think what's nice about this is it suggests to me that this book, at this point, the very beginning of the 18th century, is not shut away in the what in that period was the sort of masculine space of the library. It seems that it is out and available. We don't know whether the family were horrified that Elizabeth had done all this drawing, but she's clearly had quite a while to do it, hasn't she? She hasn't just gone, you know, in a sort of moment of the book being unguarded. So it gives us a sense, where's this book in the household? What kind of people are reading it? Is it part of the serious world of the study? Is it more part of more female spaces in the house? And we do see a large number of early readers who put their names in this book who are women. Some of them we've got here. Mary Chapman, I always like. I wonder if she thought, God, if only I'd moved over a bit, I would have been able to get my name all in one go. And up there, Thomas and Isabella Harvey from Ickworth Manor in Suffolk. And Anne Hurl, she's there in the middle there, putting her name three times, actually. You think, oh, Anne, are you okay, love? All around Othello, the last scene of Othello. I don't know if it's a cry for help, but we're a bit late to help, I think. Lots of people wrote their names in copies of this book and in other books from this period, and they didn't always do it at the beginning. They did it perhaps by some bit that was interesting or important to them particularly. And the other thing they do is to extract bits that they think are useful, beautiful, valuable. This is all what's called commonplacing, that's to say extracting the best bits for writing into a commonplace book or for reuse. Commonplacing is obviously a sort of anticipates our practices of quotations from Shakespeare, but one of the ways in which it's different, I think, is that quotations from Shakespeare usually for us are completely unique ways of saying something that you couldn't mistake for anything else. Whereas for early readers, the great phrase was something that you might be able to slip into your own writing or you might be able to learn from. It was a more directly useful one. My favourite example of this is always The Tempest. The Tempest is the first book, first play, as we already saw in this book. And lots of readers, I think, attacked this big book with great gusto and thinking, I'm going to really improve myself by reading this book. And they tend to peter out, but it means that The Tempest is often very extensively commonplaced. And if you thought about The Tempest now, you'd probably say, You probably pick out Prospero's great speech, "Our revels now are ended," for example, or you might think about Miranda's line, "Brave new world that hath such people in't." But in fact, early readers don't tend to notice those because they're not necessarily all that useful in everyday life. And the scene that they absolutely love is a scene where a sort of slightly wide boy, Ferdinand, who has been shipwrecked on the island, is chatting up Miranda with these incredibly, even she realizes these lines are so cheesy, but you can see these readers thinking, oh God, that's a killer line, and that's absolutely great. So it's a different sense of what's important, but it's that nevertheless, a little bit what we were talking about in the sonnet session earlier, if you were there, the act of selection and of reading in bits rather than reading the whole thing. So what if we hadn't had this book? Let's just end with a kind of counterfactual. We would have had a lot of Shakespeare plays. We would have had 18 of Shakespeare's plays. But my feeling is that we would not have Shakespeare, that's to say, the literary, cultural, national, global icon. We wouldn't know what Shakespeare looked like, and that's surprisingly important for how a reputation might develop. But we wouldn't have had, at certain important historical points, this big book that was just there on the shelf, waiting to be brought down. And the one example I think can stand in for quite a number is when Charles II returns to the English throne. You know that one of the things that gets restored along with the monarchy is the theatre. And Charles wants the theatre pretty much up and running, you know, next week. And he gives two commissions for theatre companies to get going. And there's this air of, you know, anxiety and sort of what are we going to do? Nobody's written a new play. Why would they have done? The theatres have been closed for 18 years. The Killigrew brothers, Charles and Edmund Killigrew, who are given one of the commissions for the king to get the theatre up and running. We know that they have a copy of the first folio. We know it. They've actually drawn a picture of their dog curled up on the front page. And it's clear that the Killigrews sort of think, oh, what are we going to do? Get this down. And they start looking and then they realise, ooh, Twelfth Night's going to be great if you can have women actors, and a woman playing a man will show a lot of leg. And that's exactly what the king would like. And so they begin the process, which we've continued ever since, of picking and choosing and adapting plays for the tastes of contemporary audiences. And without that book, I don't think it would have happened. So this is partly my kind of fun. I don't think Shakespeare would have gone global, which is the Aimé Césaire, Martinique response to The Tempest. The Stratfords all around the world would look very different. The Stratford, Ontario big Shakespeare Festival certainly wouldn't happen, but nor would it be called Stratford, Ontario. And I like the idea from these you might be wondering who these men in togas are. One of them is John Wilkes Booth, and shortly after playing Brutus in Julius Caesar, a folio-only play, he, of course, goes on to murder Abraham Lincoln. Perhaps history would have been quite different if Wilkes Booth had not learnt how effectively to be a political assassin from Shakespeare. So it's an extraordinary book. It's an extraordinary arc which has preserved Shakespeare across time. And I'm delighted to have had the chance to talk to you a bit about it this evening and to open up for questions that you might have. Thank you, Peter.
I'm just struggling with the regret that A Yorkshire Tragedy is not the original title of Richard III.
Yes.
Or indeed any of them.
Yes.
Also, I should say, Richard, listening to you then, welcome to Herefordshire, home of obviously Sarah Siddons and David Garrick, but most of all, given your last thing, Nell Gwynn. Great favourite, and apparently one of the first women to play women's roles in, with the approval of canine enthusiasm. Can I just ask you to... I realise this is a very big question, but given that this happens 7 years after Shakespeare died, and that the versions in the First Folio of the plays are not always aligned with what we've seen from the quartos, what do we know about how the content that is presented in the First Folio survived Shakespeare? And do we know that Condell and Heming had original manuscripts? What were they working for? Or is that simply beyond our collection?
No, so it's a really important question. And one of the ways that I have found it easier to think about is to call these plays scripts. As soon as you call them scripts, you are much, much more open to the idea, or attuned to the idea, that they will change across time and that they will be in motion, really, rather than a fixed book. This is a script that actors will pick up. They may change it for one performance or for a court performance or for a revival or something. And so there are lots of dramatic reasons, theatrical reasons, why we have differences between versions of Shakespeare's plays. One of the things that I think is really interesting about First Folio studies right now is we've spent time thinking about where the folio gives us a text different from a quarto. So King Lear is a really good example, where there's obviously been rewriting, most people think by Shakespeare, between the version that's performed and printed early in the 17th century and the one that appears in the folio. But I think now we're interested in plays which only appear in the folio, so only appear perhaps 20 years after they were originally performed, and starting to say, is it really likely that the script that's produced there or reproduced in the folio is exactly the same as it was 20 years previously performed? I don't really think so. And I've been working a lot on Twelfth Night recently, which is a folio-only play, and which has, very unusually for Shakespeare, an eyewitness account of somebody who saw it. John Manningham sees it at the Middle Temple in 1601 or something. And so we seem to have a perfect, you know, we know the date of the play and here's the text of the play. But I'm really interested in how we could see what might have happened to it in those 20 years. And a play like Macbeth, for instance, we now think the version of Macbeth we have is almost certainly a Shakespeare original overwritten by Thomas Middleton, probably after Shakespeare's death. And the Shakespeare original without Middleton, we just don't have anymore. And in a way, that's because we value Shakespeare more than Middleton, that's a problem. But if we value the theatre, then we would think, of course, that's the version we would have kept.
Can I ask you sort of a itsy-bitsy question about punctuation?
Yes. How well you know me, Peter. How well you know me.
Well, there's two parts of this. Number one, there's just the dialogue. Very little except scenery description or stage directions, except as given in the dialogue. Number two, how do we assume, and who do we assume, put in the commas and the semicolons and the full stops? Because there are radical choices that are made about the way these lines are delivered. And it clearly wasn't Shakespeare who punctuated this text.
Yeah, so almost all stage directions in modern texts of Shakespeare have been put there by editors. And I've heard lots and lots of directors, modern directors, say the first thing we do in rehearsal is just cross out all the stage directions and we start just with the dialogue and we work out what needs to happen. This punctuation is really interesting. We have got one potential manuscript, theatrical manuscript, in Shakespeare's handwriting, and it's a multi-authored play called Sir Thomas More, and we've got the Book of Sir Thomas More, the script of a play as used in the theatre would have been called the Book of and this is Thomas More. And in I raise that because it's a slight question mark whether it is Shakespeare's handwriting. But if it is, one of the interesting things it shows us is there is almost, I think there is no punctuation whatsoever. It is just not, the handwriting is not punctuated.
This is hand D.
This is hand D, exactly. Hand D in the manuscript of Thomas More. So that might suggest, as we have come to assume, that punctuation is probably done in the print house, and it's probably done by compositors, and that it has a purpose both to sort of pass the syntax of the sentence, but it probably also has a function in justification. You can put in a comma, just as you can put in an E at the end of a word, if you're actually trying to spread out the line so that you can, make it firm in the case. So punctuation in the print house probably has the purpose of making the text make sense in a certain way, but it also probably has the purpose of making the line work technically. And that means that it's probably less reliable as a guide to how the text should be spoken than we have thought. And there are other punctuation things. There's no exclamation mark really in early modern printing. So when Macbeth says to Lady Macbeth, Macbeth says, if we should fail, Lady Macbeth says, we fail, and there's a question mark. And nobody is quite sure whether that means it is a question mark or whether it's one of the question marks that seems to be an exclamation mark, because there isn't an exclamation mark in early modern printing.
Is it Ralph Crane, the compositor, who is a big fan of exclamation marks?
Ralph Crane is a big fan of brackets, parentheses.
Okay.
So one argument about the first folio is the first folio publication process is that it started off ambitiously and then became a bit more pragmatic as the scope and the time that was being taken and everything became clear. Because certainly the first five or six plays in that pile of comedies that they're working through look to have been prepared in a special, super clean, well-organized manuscript by the scribe of the King's Men, who's a man called Ralph Crane. And Crane likes to organize a dramatic manuscript in a particular way. He likes to have a heading at the beginning of the scene of everybody who's going to come in at any point in the scene, so that they can all sort of get ready somehow. They're sometimes called masked entrances. And he's also really keen on hyphenation. So he often puts words together. A lot of the words in The Tempest, which we think of as being a wonderful example of late style by Shakespeare, sort of tempest-tossed, those kinds of sea change, all that vocabulary yoked together with hyphens, might well be Crane rather than Shakespeare. But Crane has done these lovely, and with these brackets, he loves a bracket. So he will put a kind of aside comment in brackets. And some of that has made its way through. Yeah, Crane is interesting.
Can I ask just one last question before just opening this to the floor? There are 954 pages in this. It's a big book. It sells for £1. So it's a sort of LMVH deluxe thing. Did people buy it thinking it was an investment?
No, I don't think they did. If they did, it was a very, very long-term investment. I think for 150 or 160 years, the first folio is less valuable than the price paid for it. So it isn't until really the end of the 18th century that this book becomes valuable and then super valuable. And certainly, the Bodleian Library in Oxford, which is my local library and a wonderful, wonderful place, got a copy of the first folio at the end of 1623 and sent it off to be bound and then had it chained in the library. But when the third folio came out, which advertised seven new plays, they thought, well, great, we don't need both. and they got rid of the first. And that was obviously a big mistake, but it was a completely logical mistake at that period where there was no particular value on the first, and in fact, a strong sense of progress that things got better. And instead of going back to the first one, you would get the most recent one, and that would be better.
Sorry, there are two questions. First, print run was what?
Well, we usually say 750. Print runs were capped at about 1,100. It probably wasn't as much as that because the investment in paper for that would have been huge. Yeah. My assessment of the costs, the fixed costs plus the paper, was that you probably needed to sell 70% of the copies before you made the profit. So the profit was on the probably the last.
And this is, these are the seven plays that come out in the third. What are they?
Well, they are a strange assortment. I mean, one we know and we have taken to our hearts, Pericles, which we know to be, at least in part, by Shakespeare. But they are Sir John Oldcastle, Locrine, The London Prodigal. They're an arrangement of plays that have sometimes been associated with Shakespeare, but they are opportunistically added in by the printer to try to, you know, establish this as a new book. Right. And I think to get people to buy it, probably who already owned an earlier copy.
Brilliant. Emma, thank you very much. Can we take questions, please? First one from the gentleman here. Be great if everyone who asks a question could just wait for the microphone just so we can amplify your voice to everyone online and also record you for posterity.
That last answer, can you tell us a bit about what further folios there were? Because there are second, third, fourth, and maybe more. And which ones would have been used by actors who put on the plays, either in Charles II's time or in the 18th century, Garrick and so forth.
Thanks. That's a really great question, because this book only becomes the first folio when we get a second. I mean, it's a retrospective title. We get a second edition of this book in 1632, so 9 years after the first, and then we get a third in 1663 and a fourth in 1685. And what that means is that throughout the 17th century, Shakespeare almost entirely circulated in collected editions. So although we often, and quite rightly, say without this book, we would not have preserved these plays, we also have to acknowledge that for the rest of the 17th century, the circulation of Shakespeare's plays was actually restricted by being held in a monopoly, only printed in these expensive multiplay volumes. So you couldn't buy a sixpenny copy of Hamlet. You had to buy a pound copy of the second folio. What actors would have used is a really good question. We've got a couple of copies where it looks that actors have disassembled the book to make it easier to work from, because it's a very difficult, unwieldy book to work from. But we're still in an era throughout the 17th century where it is relatively cheap and available to get a scribe to copy out again. And that's what most of our scripts from that period are.
When does international translation start and the global power of Shakespeare take off? I ask this partly because I was with a fantastic woman who runs the Gdansk Shakespeare Festival. And just picking up on this wonderful last slide here, in a country where everything is still censored in the way that it might have been here in the in Elizabethan times, she said the one thing we can always do is play Shakespeare, and the one thing that does more political work than anything else is playing Shakespeare.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And there's been a really fascinating East European and Russian tradition of Shakespeare, which has been very politically engaged. If you look at the East European Hamlet, for instance, it's not at all about the sort of inner turmoil, the Oedipal complex, any of that kind of bourgeois nonsense. It's about what it is to be a kind of refusenik who can't speak in an oppressive regime. It's a completely different, wonderfully different play in that tradition. So Shakespeare's company, there are English players who go to Northern Europe, go touring in Northern Europe in the 16th century. We know that. And there are German adaptations of Shakespeare's plays in the early years of the 17th century. So translation begins very, very early. Wow. We don't get full translations of all of Shakespeare until we get German sort of halfway through the 18th century. And Shakespeare really goes global when English as a language goes global, and that's with Empire. Okay. So that's when these plays really move.
Great. Question from the internet.
From Alan Lloyd. Did portfolios 3 and 4 differ much from 1 and 2? Were there corrections and adjustments?
Interesting question. Yes. They were all retypeset. So one of the things they have is their own mistakes, as well as some corrections. Someone has looked over the second folio who knows Latin better than Jaggard's print shop knew Latin, and the Latin and also classical names have been tidied up considerably in the second. The third and fourth have these extra plays, and so one of the things that's interesting about the way that the same words are reset is how you can see the language or the sort of the typography changing. That's to say, by the time we get the third folio, most nouns are capitalized, which is a thing that you would see in Pope or, you know, you would recognize from that period, whereas they're not previously. So there are tiny ways in which the language is actually being updated. So that's a process which is happening through those folios. I can see, but I'm not looking at Peter looking at his watch. I just am keeping going.
No, it's not because I want to stop you. As a sort of corollary to that, do the Jaggards like win here? Are they the ones who are doing folios 2, 3, 4, or has it passed on?
It's passed on. Right. Isaac Jaggard is dead by the time of the second folio, so his rights have passed on, and they pass on to a consortium, which may suggest that the risk for a small publisher-printer combination like the first folio is quite high, and it's preferable to spread that across a larger group of men in the industry, and that's what happens in the second, third, and fourth folios. We used to think that Edward Blunt, who had been a very prominent and literary publisher, Blunt has got an amazing eye for picking. He picks Montaigne, he picks Don Quixote, he picks he picks various kinds of amazing European classics, and he seems to have picked Shakespeare. And he publishes, people have looked at, he publishes maybe 3 or 4 books in a year, all through his career. And then after the Shakespeare folio, doesn't publish anything for 5 years. And he gets, as a grown-up, fully-fledged publisher, he actually gets poor relief from the Publishers Guild, from the stationers. And we used to think that was that he had been bankrupted by his investment in the folio. We now think that he may have also pursued a very, very unwise legal case and bankrupted it himself that way. But it is an interesting...
Otherwise known as a legal case.
Yes, a legal case, not even a bankrupting one. Yeah, yeah.
It's incredible to think of those 750 original copies. How many of them have survived? I mean, not all of them at the Folger Library, but there are almost half of them that are still in circulation and are now worth what?
So there are about 230 copies extant, as far as we know. Some of those are probably cannibalised versions of slightly messed up copies, so they may represent bits of more copies than that. The most recent sort of complete copy went for sale with Christie's New York in October 2020, and that was a record price, just under $10 million hammer price. But there have been some slightly cheaper, but not massively cheaper versions than that. And that's strange because it's not actually As we've just said, it's not a rare book. So the first edition of Hamlet from 1603 exists in two copies, both incomplete, although happily incomplete in different ways. That is a rare book. Or, you know, the Gutenberg Bible now very, very rarely comes on the market. It's a book which has been withdrawn really from the market, from circulation. Whereas the first folio keeps being, you know, there are copies relatively often. So if you, it's a book that all through the last couple of centuries, if you've had the money, which I know is a big if, you have been able to get one. Whereas that's not true of many books that we think of as important volumes.
Can I ask one last question? And I realise I am talking to the Oxford Professor of Shakespeare Studies. One of the implications of the uncertainty of the creation of these texts, and this applies just as much to the plays, more to the plays rather than to the sonnets, but also, I guess, to the sonnets, is that the editorial opportunity that it provides has, alongside being the greatest gift to theatre audiences in the world, has given academia, has given scholarship the most incredible and enduring and exciting life, hasn't it? I mean, not only because we can all debate in a sort of Talmudic way the integrity of the text, but there is almost no other writer whose contemporaneity is so permanent.
I think that's true, and it's hard to get behind that, really. I mean, part of that, I think, is intrinsic to the way Shakespeare writes and the way the works have been transmitted to us. And part of it, I think, actually is a version of what you've just said, is the commitment and energy and creativity that keeps being poured back into Shakespeare, not primarily through scholarship, but through theatre, through other kinds of artistic and creative endeavour. We are giving back an enormous amount of energy to Shakespeare, which continues, then produces more, you know, new ideas in turn. So we're in a virtuous circle, I think, although I have some sympathy with the cries for a sort of moratorium sometimes. I think.
Do you? Yeah, but we're more with Henning and Condell, aren't we?
Read him.
If you don't get it, you haven't been trying hard enough, or maybe keep going, stick at it. It will never not reward you.
Thank you.